So MCAFM, tonight we're following up our crime week that we ran on MCAFM a few weeks ago. Tonight we're joined by Peter Marland, the Labour leader of Milton Keynes Council, and Matthew Barber, who is the Conservative Chief and Crime Commissioner for Thames Valley Police. It's MCAFM, it's Crime Week, it's a follow-up to a series of interviews that we did a few weeks ago. Delighted to say we've got the leader of Milton Keynes Council, Peter Marland, Labour-led council, of course, and Matthew Barber, who is the Police and Crime Commissioner appointed by the Conservatives. Good evening to you both.
Hey.
Good evening.
So we was in, must have been, what, a couple of months ago now? I don't know the exact date. All round, a lot of things have happened, haven't they, over the last few weeks?
So certainly been a busy time, lots going on, and a lot of work to do to keep Milton Keynes safe.
All right, let's talk about the Operation Deter, which was launched a few weeks ago.
Well, Op-Deter.
Op-Deter.
I would call it.
Yeah, Op-Deter.
Everything's in the eye of the, or the ear of the beholder.
It couldn't be any simpler, could it, really? But a dramatic difference with the way that the police are tackling this now with some new powers.
So I hope so. So it's not really new powers. It's perhaps using the powers that existed differently, and maybe taking a different approach. So there's several bits to Operation Deter, working very closely with the council. So the first bit is about the criminal justice element and taking a much tougher approach to knife possession, so not just other knife offences where you get to the more serious end where someone's actually been assaulted, but simply the possession offence and really focusing on those. Where possible, separating them out for other offences, getting people into custody, charging them, remanding them overnight where possible, rather than some of the much slower processes that existed in the past. And that, hopefully, is starting to bear fruit around the speed of police action, but also working closely with the youth offending team in Milton Keynes. We're funding the recruitment of some new officers who will do the early intervention bit in custody, particularly with the under 18s, so that rather than at the moment, again, the processes can take weeks before someone's in contact, 90 minutes from when police custody call the youth offending team to when they can get someone into custody to see that young person. If we can deliver that, the turnaround in response will be huge. But it's not just a quick flash in the pan. This is part of a long-term ongoing programme.
Here to stay.
It's here to stay, but it's about tackling that wider culture. I talked about it last time. We have to challenge the culture of knife carrying, which exists for far too many young people particularly. And that is something that will take time, always does when you're tackling a culture. So it's not just about those who might have been stopped last night, this week with a knife. Is that underlying issue that we've got in wider society that we need to tackle.
And I know it's still very early days, but does it appear to be making a difference at the moment as regards as offending and people's attitude to carrying a knife? I know it's very, very early days, but from where I'm sitting today, I think we've, you know, touched wood, we've had less instances over the last few weeks than what we did certainly before you was in last time.
So I hope it will make that difference. I am very cautious about the fact we are only a month into this. Where
yeah.
we have definitely seen improvements is in that criminal justice bit. So we've seen, I think, three times the number of people who've been charged and remanded. We've seen people arrested by the police, charged within 4 hours, in the cells overnight, in front of the magistrates the next morning. That whole bit of the process is working really well.
Often, and that is here to stay. That hasn't just happened for a press release or anything like that.
This is here to stay. Officers in Thames Valley love it. Milton Keynes officers who are dealing with this, they feel empowered because they got rid of some of the bureaucracy that was there before. We're working really closely with defence barristers. We're working with the magistrates and the judiciary to explain to them the why we're doing it, and I fully expect that in a couple of months' time, once we've ironed out all the details, it won't just be here to stay in Milton Keynes. We'll be rolling it out across the rest of the Thames Valley, and indeed, we're talking to other police forces who are really interested in the more simplified processes we're using.
And I think it's been really well received from the public, just from what I can make out. It's more or less along the lines of what the public would have expected to be happening in the first place.
Absolutely. It shouldn't be anything revolutionary. It should be what the public expect. And I'm really pleased with the way Thames Valley have managed to grasp this and deal with it. I think your longer term question about will it have an impact, as I say, that I think the impact is really about the culture. It only takes one horrific incident to undermine that confidence. So it will take time to change that culture. I wouldn't ever suggest we've somehow found a magic fix to this problem, but the criminal justice bit is starting to work. What we need to do is make sure that message spreads across the wider community that if you carry a knife, you are more likely to be stopped, and if you're stopped, you are much more likely to face a criminal justice outcome. I think we will see that coming along over the coming months, because we've got people to court pretty quickly. We've got a couple of convictions already. We've still got some where the courts are waiting to try and sentence people. But what we will see is where first offences might generate community sentences, unpaid work, those sorts of things. For second offences, there is a mandatory 6-month prison sentence. I think many people would argue it should be for a first offence, but that we're dealing with the law as it is. And I think if we see people who go through this process and they reoffend, Thames Valley Police will be focusing on those individuals. And if we end up with them in court again, we're going to see some much harsher sentences. That's all part of that that whole programme to deter people from carrying knives on our streets. It will take some time to get there, but I think we're on the right track.
Peter, as your perspective then, leader of the council, is this a good step forward? Do you begin to see a difference from where you sit?
Yeah, I mean, I think both very clear, Matt's very clear that it is very early days, and as a council, obviously our powers aren't in the criminal justice area or the policing area. Our powers are around that longer term deterrent or educational aspect of. That's why we're working together is so important, because our focus as a council is in funding the courses through the schools and the safety centre to make sure that people, young people in particular, know the consequences of carrying a knife, or actually working, for instance, one of the areas that I think we're really united on is appealing to parents, because carrying a knife as a sort of 16-year-old, you'll have seen it, people will always say on the comments underneath some posts on Facebook, you know, what's the point of a knife amnesty? If you're going to stab someone, you're not going to hand the knife in. Well, actually, if you're a parent of a 16, 17-year-old and you know they might be carrying a knife, it's probably those people we need to be appealing to hand the knife in, sort of on behalf of the young people or children, so they're not carrying it in the first place, and giving parents the confidence to actually speak to their children, speak to young people, speak to the police, speak to people in social services if they're worried about the children. That's that long-term aspect that we need to be concentrating on, because culture isn't just deterring people from carrying a knife today, it's understanding the consequences of carrying a knife tomorrow, but also making sure they don't want to carry a knife in the first place.
And I think that's the thing, because there are going to be some people, I guess, that whatever you do, they are going to carry a knife, unfortunately, but I guess that the operation is more about those people that could end up leading into carrying a knife because someone else is.
Absolutely. I think you've got two groups to boil it down. There's obviously the real world is much more complex, but you've got two groups of people that we've seen involved in offending in Milton Keynes and across Thames Valley. You've got some frankly hardened criminals who will break the law as a way of life, and they will use violence as a means to an end. You also have some misguided young people who've got themselves involved in something and taken a step too far, and the consequences of that are tragic. The wider change in culture is clearly aimed at that wider group, because they actually are the ones who pose the threat to the children and the young people that we will know and love in Milton Keynes. The hardened criminal element is still impacted by the tough criminal justice sanctions, but that's obviously less impacted by the cultural change. But I think it was really important what Pete was just saying about that appeal to parents, is the carrot and the stick, because the carrot is that there is a huge amount of support available to young people and parents if they think that their child is involved in crime of any kind, but particularly around knife crime. And through the police, through the council, there is a huge amount of support there to try and understand what the issues might be with that young person, to safeguard them if necessary, and to really divert them away from that life of crime. And that's the carrot that we offer out to people, that actually if you have concerns, don't try and deal with it yourself. Reach out for help. There are lots of organisations, voluntary and public sector, that can help you. Because if you don't reach out for that help for your child and they're caught by the police, there will be consequences to that. And it will be too late when you're son is in the magistrate's court, and you think, well, you know, mate, I always had my concerns, my suspicions, but I didn't want to say anything because I was concerned about social service. I was concerned about the impact.
Yeah.
The message is, if you come forward now with that intent, that ask for help, the help will be there. We're not looking to criminalise people unnecessarily, but if you wait until they're stopped by a police officer, then it will be too late, because we need to take a tough approach to make sure we get the knives off our streets.
And what difference is there for, say, the hardened criminal? Is there any difference as regards to the way that they're going to be dealt with? Because I guess that, you know, whatever the court does, they're still going to go about their activity, be it county lines, drugs, you know.
Well, that's one of the reasons for why the speed of turnaround is important. Right. It's not just about the deterrent effect. If, for example, you've got someone who's suspected of drug dealing, and they're also found with a knife on them. Now, that drug dealing charge may take some time to bring to court because of the testing needed of the drugs, because of the CCTV evidence that's perhaps needing to be gathered. Now, if the police release that person under investigation, then they're out there and they're free to carry on their criminality while the police investigate, and hence the delays in courts cause so many problems. But actually, if while that investigation is ongoing around the drug offence, they can be charged for possession of a weapon, which is a much more clear-cut offence, and we can get them off the streets on those charges, actually we can tackle both elements at the same time.
Is there any changes at all since we spoke on local provisions as regards as youth clubs and getting behind boxing clubs and all that type of stuff? Because I know that we've had a number of press releases, but I think getting kids off the street in the first place, you know, is a key element of this. Is there any update from you, Peter? I know that we talked about youth clubs.
So I think, again, that's a targeted intervention. I mean, as a council, we don't have a ton of money, and I'd love to go back to the days where we've got a sort of a universal youth service, but we just don't have that, and we don't have the capacity to do that. So our intervention is looking at those areas where those interventions will be of most use. We've been running youth services down on the Lakes Estate, because actually part of this is that long-term aim is, it's a choice, and it's always a choice. It doesn't feel like a choice at the time, no doubt, for the people involved, but it's a choice between here's a lifestyle over here and here's a lifestyle over here. One of the lifestyles is drug dealing and antisocial behaviour, and another is sort of work and making sure that you're providing for your family and things. And it's that throughput. So and that's linked very heavily to our regeneration and renewal scheme. So we're funding some work on the Lakes Estate and the next estate, where that's going to roll out over the next 6 months, is full as Slade. And then we are working, I know, with Thames Valley Police about looking at how we can fund some of those extra activities. So I know that there's a club that takes place in my ward. It's a boxing club in New Bradwell, and actually it takes young people off the streets. And the more that we can get the voluntary services and the VSE sector to do some of that stuff, I think it's massively important. And that's why actually the Summer of Play, I know it's a sort of, it sounds like a young people, a children's title, but actually there's a lot of activities there for young people over the summer. And no doubt Matt will tell you, but the police are often really worried about summer activities. That's the time when longer days, kids go out, they sit on park benches or whatever. So making sure that we've got activities for kids over the summer has been a huge thing that we've had to do as a council. And I think we've doubled the amount of placements this year on Summer of Play, because it's really vital we get kids off the street and actually doing sort of structured activity.
And I know one of the conversations that we had in the past was about the cost of setting up you know, new centres for youth clubs and all that type of thing. Do you think there's buildings like schools and that could be used in partnership with the voluntary sector to help get kids off the street?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, again, I always think back to when I was a teenager, and you've got to appeal to people. You can't just put something on and expect kids to turn up. And quite frankly, if there was the same type of kids will go to an activity in a school, whether it's run by the school or whether it's run by the council or whoever. We need to make sure that we're running activities that, and this is what I mean by targeted activities, that activities that people who may carry a knife or may get involved in other sorts of criminal activity or pathways to criminal activity actually want to take part in, because it's pointless doing stuff in a school. Why at the end of a day at 3:30 if you've been in school all day and you've hated it there, why would you want to go back to school at 6 o'clock in the night to do youth service? You know, you just wouldn't. And so we need to make sure that we're working with young people and not just the normal voices of young people who tend on the whole to be whiter and tend to be more middle class. What we need to do is talk to communities that would use those services and actually get them to tailor those services for themselves. And that's what we've been doing on Lakes, and that's what we're doing on Fuller Slade.
Okay, we're going to be back in just a couple of minutes talking about safer streets and CCTV, and also £750,000, which is coming to help fund this. It's MCAFM Tuesday evening. Tuesday evening across Milton Keynes. So last night we were talking to Ben Everett about £750,000 of national funding that's coming to Milton Keynes. Ben knew some of the details on this, Peter, but not all of it. But I believe it's going to be money that Milton Keynes Council is going to be spending to ensure safer streets. So maybe you can talk us through how this money's come about and how it's going to be spent.
Oh, yeah, it's a great bid. And it's another bid in partnership. So I think that's been really good, and what we're looking to do is make sure that particularly the city centre, but the links to the city centre as well, are safer, and this money is focused on safer streets, particularly for girls and women. And interestingly, that links into the European Championship win that I've been talking about a lot over the past couple of days, as you can imagine. And one of the things, what are you going to do to boost women participation, not just in football but in sport? And I say, well, as a sort of middle-aged man, when I want to go for a run to do 5K, I don't have to think about other things. I don't have to think about sort of whether I need to carry my keys between my fingers in case I'm assaulted. I don't need to think about that sort of thing. And lots of women do. They can't just put on a pair of trainers and go for a run. So what we're trying to do, particularly in the city centre, is make the place feel safer. So that is more money going to be invested in lighting, more money for some CCTV, and some of those links into Loughton, into Conanbury, into Bradwell, making those safe as well, and doing some of that work on the Redway. So I think it's really vital, and I know Matt probably knows more than me about the work that happens at the MK Safety Hub on weekend nights. Money's going to be invested in that to upgrade that as well, to have those safe spaces for not just women but for people who feel threatened at all can go to those safe spaces, or maybe they've indulged too much in alcohol somewhere for them to sit and rather than not sort of everybody who listens to your program will know Milton Keynes City Centre of a Saturday night is not Manchester, it's not Liverpool, it's not London. You don't get so much passing traffic. Maybe if you've had a bit too much to drink and you sort of sit down on a curb somewhere, it's very isolating. So making sure people have got safe spaces there as well. So it's a whole range of things to make people safer in the city centre and some of the surrounding walkways and redways.
So there's quite a debate between the two of you last time about CCTV. Has there been any developments on that? Is there going to be any additional funding for CCTV? It didn't seem as if it was going to be an easy fix.
I mean, when we came on the radio last time, and actually I think what came out of that debate is, and meeting Matt since, is I don't think the debate was between Milton Keynes Council and the Police and Crime Commissioner's Office. I think it was the local Conservative Party had done something different locally, and they were offering something different. But Matt and I have had a conversation about CCTV. He's got a very specific offer that's going out. I think that's a good offer. I'm working with officers to make sure we can link in to that offer going forward. Matt probably wants to explain what that offer is. But I've always been clear that the Milton Keynes use of fixed point CCTV needs to be where it's needed most, and that is the city centre, because you can't have CCTV everywhere. So if it is not all underpasses, because our redways are really, really safe actually if you look at the figures, but there are some places that actually do attract a certain level of antisocial behaviour, that's where we want to focus our CCTV resource. We don't want it absolutely everywhere and not being of use. So I don't think there's any disagreement that mobile CCTV is best where mobile CCTV is best, and fixed point cameras, because they cost a lot, are probably better for things like crowd management, late night economy control, and in places of sort of high use or high areas of drug dealing, places like certain car parks, etc., etc. I don't think there was any argument between us. I think where the argument was just CCTV, to me, was being used during the last local elections as a sort of replacement for the local Conservatives for as a coda for the, not as much need for police.
Yeah, I think there was allegations, weren't there, last time that CCTV wasn't working, the council had been given some money and it wasn't used, and then, you know, someone sitting in front of it, there was a bit of a debate around that. So, Matt, do you want to come in here?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an issue which, frankly, is wider than Milton Keynes for me in Thames Valley. The issue around local funding for CCTV, it varies between local authorities, you know, from Milton Keynes all the way down to Berkshire and over in Oxfordshire. The systems are different. They don't talk to each other. They don't all link into police systems. For me, my ambition is to build a network of CCTV in the public realm, which will link across all of those areas. And that means renewing a lot of the cameras that are in places like Milton Keynes, where there's quite an old stock of cameras. And that's one of the things we discussed last time. In the shorter term, we are putting in some additional funding for some of that mobile camera. I've agreed some funding locally for the police in Milton Keynes to use in particular hotspots, often in covert areas. I think some of that £750,000for the Safer Streets programme, there's a small element of that which is for mobile CCTV as well. But that's part of the here and now of making Milton Keynes safer now, this week, this year. The longer term strategy is about building a really reliable, robust network of CCTV that can aid the police not just in catching criminals and bringing them to justice, hugely important though that is. And I spent this morning with some of our CCTV team at headquarters who do the analysis of CCTV, but actually proactively using it for crime prevention, where you've got a monitored system which can actually help to direct the police, help to avert instances from happening. We've seen in Milton Keynes and elsewhere where CCTV can be used incredibly well to protect people. It's not a panacea, but it's a really useful tool. And I think it's going to take some long-term investment and strategy from both the council and the police. But I think we're in the same place about where we want to get to.
Brilliant. And I know that we've already talked about women feeling safer on the street. And obviously, you know, the statistics from where I sit, I guess, doesn't show the full picture. We touched on this slightly yesterday with Ben Everett, but sexual offences is on the increase, a big increase.
It is. And this is something that I've talked. We've now got a superintendent who's leading all of the work across the force to bring it all into one place. Around rape and sexual offences. We are seeing an increase, and I wouldn't for a moment be complacent about that. But what I think it does reflect, talking to those officers who are involved in those cases, I think it most likely reflects an increase in confidence in reporting. When you look at the age of some of those cases, for all sorts of reasons that people will understand, it can take a lot of confidence, a lot of guts to report an incident to the police. These aren't necessarily things that people will report. Something happened last night and they're straight on the phone to the police. That will happen, and I'd encourage it, obviously. But we're seeing more and more cases being reported that perhaps happened months, years ago. And that's good because, frankly, those offenders will often still be out there offending again. They often won't be isolated instances. We know when someone gets away with it, they are more likely to reoffend. So I want women, and it is mostly women, to report.
I don't want people shouting at their radio saying, what about men are suffering?
I completely agree. And I stress it is mostly women, but it's by no means exclusively women. Anybody who has been a victim of rape and sexual assault, these are horrific crimes that can destroy people's lives. But I think what hopefully that number does represent is the increased confidence in reporting, because what I'm not seeing in the figures I've seen in the conversations with senior officers in Thames Valley is an increase in incidents that are happening week in, week out. It's about the confidence in reporting. It's a very similar situation to what we've seen over domestic violence over the years. Domestic abuse is still hugely underreported by all of those organisations that are out there working with victims. They all assess that it is underreported. So I want to see more people reporting. I don't think that means it's, you're more likely to be a victim now than you were in the 1970s, but I think it means you're much more likely to come forward to get the support of the police, for someone to be brought to justice and to get the support you deserve. So in those areas, I think we're probably seeing a positive trend.
I mean, where I would challenge on this is perhaps it's not necessarily the police, but the police do play a big role in it, is I don't think anybody in this country thinks that we are being successful in prosecuting and bringing offenders to justice on sexual crime. Women in particular, are being let down by the number of prosecutions and the number of convictions on rape and serious sexual offences, and it's just not right, because Matt's right, it does take an enormous amount of guts to come forward to report a sexual offence, and we've got to scratch the surface and ask why is that, and that's because you've seen it with recent sort of high profile cases of, you know, it's the woman that's put on trial, it's the woman's life that's pulled apart, we cannot continue on that. And I think there was an incident recently in the north where actually it was the police that were actually saying, "Oh well, are you sure you want to go forward with this?" And it's not just about reporting, and it's about making sure that the officers are involved, are fully trained, the evidence is collected properly, and there's proper support for victims to make sure that there's the best chance of conviction, and that we've got a job to do as society to make sure that when things go to court, it isn't just a case of, "Oh well, he said, she said, we'll split down the middle and acquit," because that's not how consent works. But that's, unfortunately, all the evidence about particularly jury trials is that's how juries think. Juries think of, you know, if two people are locked in a room and one person says one thing and one person says another, is that enough to convict? And unfortunately, women are not believed, and we have to do a lot more work to make sure that, yes, it's possibly true, although I've not seen any evidence that that the reporting of sexual violence and sexual assaults are going up because people are more likely to report them, but convictions are not going up, and that is not good enough.
I guess, Matt, it's the same with the knife crime, isn't it? A clear message has got to be sent, you know, to people that are involved in this, that there are consequences to their decisions.
I completely agree, and I think the point that Pete raises around the criminal justice system, I don't think anybody could disagree with the situation in this country, is absolutely dire, and frankly, we're not immune from that. It's an issue partly for the police, not entirely, has been said, but those instances which have been referred to where, you know, effectively a force might be seen to be almost discouraging a woman from pursuing it, I wouldn't like to suggest that that's never happened in Thames Valley, because I think that would sadly be naive, but we are definitely trying to address the risk of that. And I think two specific things, and there's a lot more but it's worth mentioning, are that there's now a review in place for any rape investigation that is discontinued, where no further actions proposed. There is a review taken of that, so it's not just the discouragement of a victim, for example, and to make sure that they have examined all of those possible lines of inquiries before no further action is taken. And we'll see an increase. We've had some successful cases already, but we'll see an increase in evidence-led prosecutions where the victim may no longer be supportive of the case because they don't want to go to court. They don't want the turmoil and the trauma of going through it again. But actually, the police may well be able to take the evidence they've got from the body-worn video, that first interview with the victim when they first came in, the CCTV evidence, all of those other things. Clearly, it's dependent on the case. But we've had some really remarkable successes, actually, where we've secured rape convictions without the victim supporting that. We need to see more of those, because we're seeing some good percentage changes, but the numbers are still far, far too low. So I think we've got perhaps some of the tools there to try and address it. But again, it comes back down to confidence, because I can't blame women, frankly, for not having believed that they would be properly dealt with by the criminal justice system in the past. But I think we are making those roads forward.
I think it's also just sort of to the point of the question, it's also really important to point out that, unfortunately, the vast, vast majority of sexual offences are committed by, are perpetrated by people who are known to the victims, whether that be children, whether that be women, whether that be men. The vast majority, whether it be in the home or other sorts of sexual violence, it's very rare for any offence to take place for what is called a sort of stranger rape, or very, very rare. But it's also really important to remember, we're talking about statistics. It's impossible to turn around to somebody and say, unfortunately, you were raped, but it was very statistically unlikely you would be so. You know, you cannot do that, and so that's why that £750,000 worth of funding is so important, because actually the vast majority of those types of offences take place where perpetrators spot an opportunity. Maybe somebody's had too much alcohol, etc., etc. It should never be the victim's fault, but absolutely we need to make sure that we've got safe spaces. But what I want to see some of that money spent on as well, and where the council need to do some more work with Matt and with the, is about making sure that particularly young men and boys are brought up in a way where they don't see an opportunity, you know, and that it's not that sort of society. And I think we need to tackle these sorts of offences at source, rather than sort of, so we need to spend more money on some societal change, not just CCTV and lighting.
Okay, we won't take another break. We'll just plough through the last couple of bits here. There was some good news on property theft, going through the figures with Ben Everett yesterday. We did talk about some that might be because people were at home during the pandemic. I think that possibly there was an increase in thefts from sheds. Motor vehicle crime seemed to be down as well. I know that when you was in last time, we had various cars being stolen from certain areas. So I guess that picture might change. But is there any update from your side? I guess the safer streets and all that is going to come into this a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, overall, there's a great statistic I can give you. Neighbourhood crime, in that burglary, robbery, theft from vehicle, theft from the person, is down 27% if you look at it pre-pandemic. And that's great. It is undeniably. People say to me, aha, it's because we're all working from home now and lives have changed. I don't care why. I'm not claiming credit for it. I think it's a good thing that crime is down. We're not mid-pandemic when people were locked up in a situation that's going to change. We're now in the new normal of the way we live our lives. So if the way we live our lives now means that you're less likely to get burgled, then I welcome it, and that's great. It's very similar, actually, to car crime. One of the reasons you saw car crime drop in the 90s wasn't because the police did an amazing job of stopping car crime. It's because it got really difficult to nick a car. I remember when you could get a Ford, and there were about two different Ford keys would open most Ford Escorts. As soon as the manufacturer ups their games, that makes a difference. So there are some big wins, I think, in that area. But there are lots of other areas of concern that we shouldn't be complacent of. I think vehicle crime is one of those. Although we've got some good reductions, I think where we're seeing that moving to is much more around things like the theft of catalytic converters. That worries me more because, frankly, it's an element of organised crime that we need to try and tackle, and from a policing tactics point of view, it's quite a challenging one to tackle, but I think there are things that can be done. And I think that one of the biggest concerns that we've seen, certainly in Milton Keynes, but it's reflected elsewhere, is around antisocial behaviour. And we see some of that around vehicles again, car meets, cruises, all those sorts of issues, and that wider issue of antisocial behaviour. And that's an area which is why it's so important that Pete and I are working really closely with between the police and the council, because a lot of those elements, by definition, antisocial behaviour often isn't criminal. It might be issues that sometimes cross the boundary into criminality. Sometimes they are just antisocial, and the solutions can often be much more complex than someone just breaking the law. Yeah. And frankly, if you're carrying a knife and a police officer stops you, that's a really easy one to deal with in criminal justice. If you're just being a pain, then that's much harder for the police and the council to get to grips with.
I mean, it would be really helpful sometimes if these messages from yourself and the chief constable maybe got through to the frontline police, because we have, before lockdown, and Darren will know, we did take quite a lot of action on car cruising. Car cruising is now, like, other than knife crime, is my number one in my inbox now. And unfortunately, when we approached the local force, the response was quite straight back, which was, we cannot afford a officer to be dealing with somebody for 40 minutes because they've got a loud exhaust or they're speeding. We cannot afford those officers on the sidelines for 40 minutes to an hour while we're issuing a fixed penalty notice because we've got, and quote, proper crimes to deal with. Now, if you're in Bradwell Common, or you're in Bradwell, or you're in Oldbrook or CMK, they are proper crimes. And sometimes I think officers, frontline officers are fantastic, but it's sometimes that middle management level that sometimes say and do things that aren't particularly helpful, and often they're in charge of where resources go today operationally. So it would be helpful if sort of Matt and the chief constable push on that, because it is, car cruising in particular, the council have done all we can now with our public space protection order, and we've given the tools to the police, but only the police can issue them. And on a Friday and Saturday night at the moment, the local force is coming back to us and saying we don't have the ability or capacity to be able to deal with this. It's not our priority. You know, I'm a partial car enthusiast. I love cars. I'm quite happy to go and look at nice cars. Doing it unsafely and doing it in a way that endangers the public, and doing it in a way that, oh well, we can just have 80 cars that turn up on a car park unannounced at 10 o'clock at night. No, because an event at the Bowl, or we were at an event in Campbell Park on Friday night, it stops at 11. And it stops at 11 to make sure that the neighbours aren't disadvantaged by that. And that's, we're quite happy to work with any organiser of any event.
It can be done in a perfectly legal and an authorised way. Which then doesn't need the heavy policing presence, which will draw resource from elsewhere dealing with those other issues. It allows the council to manage that, and the neighbours, the public, have the expectation of what's going on. But
and we haven't, as a council, we haven't sat there and gone, we're just going to make this. We do attempt to make sure that we are able to license those events. The problem with a lot of the things that me and Matt have to deal with is, on the surface, if you just pop down, very novel way to meet some constituents going to an illegal event. But if you pop down to somebody, of course the people there, they're not intrinsically bad people. But if you say to them, oh, if you want, if you could do this in a legal way, would you? And of course the answer is yes. But as soon as you start to unpick what a legal thing is, like in events insurance, you have to do it as a business, you have to have public liability insurance, you have to pay for stewarding, suddenly those people melt into the background because it's not really an organised event. Facebook is not a, it is a way of bringing lots of people together to be in the same place at the same time. It's not the same as a legally structured legal event. And sometimes it's really easy to say that they're quite happy to do a licensed event, but then when you start to, and the council have tried, start to talk to them, and again, this is that boundary of edge of criminality, is a lot of those events sort of are where things like, you know, illegal exhausts are traded, sort of overpowered engines are traded. There's a lot of not just antisocial behaviour, but edge of criminality behaviour happens at those events as well. And obviously at licensed events, that can't take place.
All right, and finally, let's talk about illegal encampments and travellers. Now, I know a few years ago, when we had the traveller situation along the V1, MCAFM had to get involved, and at that point it was very hard for the council to act on their own. At the time, Thames Valley Police weren't really being very active with what was happening in Pending Crescent. But obviously we had that incident at Oak Grove School the other week, and it seems that with the new powers that were debated and passed in Parliament, the police do have a little bit more in their arsenal to be able to tackle this.
Yeah, they do. It's not necessarily as blanket as some people might think. It still requires, you know, certain processes to be in place around the landowner asking people to move on, reasonable periods, significant disruption, some of those caveats in the guidance. But it is a good thing. I think it does give the police more power. I think in some of the instances we've seen, not just in Milton Keynes in that particular case, but elsewhere, I think perhaps the police have still been a little bit slow to act, and it's an issue I've raised with the chief constable. Thankfully, the numbers of incidents are still relatively low, and you know, to the point where I'm trying to go through each one by one to assess what could have been done better by all partners in those instances. And I think certainly the recent one we saw at Oak Grove is one to learn from. And I've been in touch with the head teacher at the school to understand things from his situation. But we are seeing a tougher, more rapid response from the police than I think you would have done a couple of years ago. The new legislation is there, it is being used, but I think we probably do still need to tighten up the details.
Well, yeah, because I think at least what's happened now is with the new powers, and it's again, I think we agree on some of the extent of those powers are misinterpreted, misrepresented. So, for instance, actually, it took the school to close to become significant community disruption. If the school hadn't closed, then actually you probably wouldn't have been able to move the travellers on. And so sort of like it's a bit faintly ridiculous that a school has to take a decision to close to get them off. It should just be you're allowed to move them on.
And I would argue, and part of my challenge back to the force is that shouldn't be the case. The assessment should be made that if this situation continues, the school will not be able to open. Therefore, there is a significant impact. And I've seen this similar elsewhere around, you know, leisure centre. There are some spaces where people can turn up. There'll be an illegal encampment. It may well still not have the permission of the landowner, but actually, it doesn't cause the significant community impact that we see when they're at schools, leisure centres, etc.
And where I am happy is it clearly defines what the council's role is and what the police's role is. And I don't think I don't think it's helpful that local councillors are coming out and MPs are coming out and saying the council needed to have done this. It wasn't council land, and the police reacted straight away. And I think
Ben made a comment yesterday that even though you had applied to the courts or something, that there wasn't an enforcement notice or something with it.
We did everything we needed to do on the Friday,
right?
And that's when the travellers were first reported. And when it's council land, we can act, but it's not. The school is a trust.
Yeah.
It is an academy. It's not council land, and that's the key to it. And I think, as a council, we also need to make sure that our policies and our assessments are up to date, because it allows the police to then take some action. So we've done some assessments around the need for how many pitches we need, whether we have a legally assessed need. For instance, for a transit site, we don't have a need for a transit site. We do provide the amount of legal pitches within our planning policy. We've got the right number of pitches coming through at the right time, and that means that the police are allowed to take action, because Matt will tell you that some authorities within his local area, but also across the country, whether you don't provide pitches, where the council assessments are out of date and where planning policy isn't up to date, it doesn't allow. There's a sort of step process that allows the police to then take that action. So we've got to make sure that our policies and our evidential base is all up to date to allow the police to basically move people on if it's an assessment to do so. And what we don't want is effectively the police to turn up at one school, move them on, and then they just appear another field down the road. That's part of the council.
And I guess that was the difference with the Oak Grove scenario, is that there were vehicles and caravans seized, which was the consequences of the actions that they'd taken.
Yeah, and I think that's certainly where the new legislation helps. And I think that's the key, is that the attitude, I think, of the police has been, you know, for many years, to move people on. And now that might be the appropriate action to be taken. But when there's examples of criminality, it might be criminal damage. There might be other issues caused on the site. I think the public feel, well, if I were to behave in that way, the police would do something about it. They wouldn't just ask me to leave the area. Whereas actually that's in the past been what the response has often been. I don't think, you know, we'll get it right in every instance. But as I said, I think the response that we saw last month was, I think, definitely better than it would have been a couple of years ago. But we're not resting on our laurels. I accept that it wasn't perfect. I think there is learning to be taken from all of these, not just Oak Grove, but every incident that happens this year.
I think the only criticism was the length of time, and that obviously kids missed their schooling for a couple of days. But I think as regards as the action and actually...
But I think timing is so important. So there will inevitably, it will need to take some time to muster those resources. There is always a need to use some numbers to deal with an incident like that, and we've still got all of the other day-to-day policing in Milton Keynes, so it's about bringing those resources in. That was done reasonably quickly in this instance, but that always causes some delay. But I think there's definitely improvements that can be done around the assessment, that bit that Pete mentioned about working with the council over the assessment process. But we're all learning, and I don't think we should be complacent about it. I think the result was pretty good this time round, but could be better, and we can learn from this and other instances to work with the council to get it better next time.
People need to get real as well, you know, and it's about that. Every incident, no matter what the incident, but if you were talking about traveller encampments, the reason why that triggered a response and required the resources, just the size of the encampment and the type of encroachment it was. Sometimes I think some members of the public, not all members of the public, some members of the public, the scale of reaction is 11, regardless of whether it's three family members of the same family travelling up, parking on the verge for one night. Yeah. They cause no trouble. They sort of pack up their rubbish afterwards. They leave it in a bag, sort of on the edge of the Redway. They move on. They go somewhere else. Sometimes the sort of community, some elements of the community will react in exactly the same way and expect exactly the same response from the council and the police as they would for 70 caravans on school playing pitches that have no toilet facilities, etc., etc. And that's just not going to happen. You know, it's all about impact on the community, impact on whether antisocial behaviour is taking place, whether criminal behaviour is taking place. Not all travellers, not all of the time, cause issues. And I think the public, it's rights and responsibilities, isn't it? Is the public just should not expect the same level of response for three caravans not harming anybody, parked up on a verge, cause no problems. Maybe if you pushed it difficult, the difference between unauthorized and illegal is really, 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 really sort of on a borderline. But you know, they might not have to be there. They probably don't have permission to be there. But if you spot them at 7 o'clock in the night and then they're gone at 7 o'clock in the morning, that's not going to get the same response.
I think things do certainly feel different after the Oak Grove incident, because when it came to the pending situation a few years ago, what was that, 2016, 2017, the encampments were burning cables, weren't they, night after night to get the metal out of them, and no action was being taken. You know, it was down to the environmental officer, I think, for Milton Keynes Council, but potentially it was illegal activity and nothing was being done. So it does seem as if things have moved forward with the new powers that the police have got.
It's not just the new legislation. It's one of the areas that I put in my police and criminal justice plan when I first came into post, and people not unreasonably said, well, that's a really specific thing that you've chosen versus all of the other problems we've got in the world. And actually the reason for it is because, as Pete just said, it's a really controversial one.
Yeah.
And because it's controversial, it's often easy just to be left at the bottom of the pile, and we'll deal with it on a case-by-case incident when it comes up. And we won't actually get a strategic grip of it. But it is one that does affect an awful lot of communities. Everybody has a view on it, on one side or the other. So it's right that we just get that right. It doesn't mean it's the priority for deployment over all those other crime types, but it does mean that we need to focus it. And hopefully what people have seen in the last month and will see, I think, in the future is we're just getting a bit more of a grip of that stuff, and where things can be improved, learning from it for the future.
All right, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time this evening, Matthew Barber. Thank you very much, and of course you, Mr. Marland.